Hey everyone, I'm your host Tom Shaughnessy and welcome back to Chain Reaction, a research-driven podcast that's a part of Delphi Digital. If you're not on Delphi's research portal, you're missing out on the critical analysis read by the top minds in the crypto space, so be sure to check it out. One quick housekeeping item, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. I may personally hold tokens mentioned on the podcast, and you can view our show notes below for our complete disclosures. With that, let's jump into the episode. Hey guys, I wanted to tell you about our new sponsor, Crypto.com. Crypto.com's exchange is a rapidly growing trading venue with a strong retail flow. Top institutions can receive a credit line and highly competitive maker-taker fees. Their platform is robust, secure, and compliant. You can get started trading today on the Crypto.com exchange, and to get in touch with their institutional sales team, visit bit.ly/CryptoDelphi now or click the link in the show notes. Now back to our show. Hey everyone, welcome back to Chain Reaction. Today, I'm super thrilled to have on Andre, who's a humble contributor to Yearn Finance. Andre, how's it going?
Hey man, glad to be here. Yeah,
it's great to have you on, Andre. I'm wondering, how much you sleep every night. That was my first question off the bat.
Not enough, that's for sure. It's getting better. It used to probably be around maybe 2 to 3 hours a night. Now I'm starting to clock in around 4 to 5. So give it another few weeks, and I should be back to a good 6 to 7 hours of sleep. The problem is there's just too much to be done right now, and my brain doesn't really let me switch off when there's problems that need to be solved. So it's a very hectic time right now, but I'm expecting that to alleviate as we address the current pressing concerns. And also, as you know, pressure subsides a little bit as well, which is good, because as the market changes, expectation changes. It's always fascinating to me, because as a builder, my views are very opposite to the speculators. So when it's a bull market, it's actually very noisy, and it's very difficult to cut through the noise and see what to focus on and see where to focus time and energy, because it feels like there's just too much, you know, it's this information overload, analysis paralysis condition, versus when markets are down, there's a lot less noise. There's a lot less, for the lack of a better word, bullshit that, you know, you need to try and wade through to get to the real value proposition. So that also helps a lot. I know that's probably a horrible thing to say, because we're in a speculative market, and here I'm saying the worse the market is, the better things are for me. But you know, that gives more time, that gives more focus, and those are two very important things to get back to a healthy and sustainable schedule.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there. It makes sense. I mean, we just went through a crypto winter a couple months ago, so I'm hoping we don't go totally back. I guess the trade-off though is, it's definitely easier to build. There's less noise. It's just really hard to incentivize people to wake up and go to work and people to get involved in the bear market. So, I mean, unless you're super dedicated, obviously you are, it's hard to get other people kind of involved in building during a bear market.
Oh, I mean, the ones that build, you know, if you compare the bear market to the current market conditions and the one we just came out of, it was the same builders building. The ones you had, which, you know, like these flash farms, so I'll call them flash builders, you know, they hop in and hop out, opportunistic in any case. They're not the ones that are going to stick around and try and continue working on something. So I tend to be on the opposite side of that statement, in that I don't really think the market makes much of a difference. I actually think the more positive the market, the more it attracts the wrong kind of builder that builds for the wrong reasons, and that subtracts on the overall ecosystem when all is said and done.
No, I think you're totally right. I mean, we've seen the last winter, we saw all the major solid projects keep building, and
I have a laundry list of names, but you know, people know who they are at this point, which is great to hear. And I guess in that line of thinking, Andre, so obviously these flash in the pan, you know, flash farms have to end. Like these fake 1000% APYs are kind of fake. And obviously we need to shift to a market where we have sustainable yields with projects building, you know, real code, new ideas, new infrastructure. Are you expecting us to get there soon? I'm just wondering like how we transition the enthusiasm from what we have today into real projects building, like the blue chips of the space.
Well, the blue chips are still building, you know, like the vision hasn't changed. The roadmaps haven't changed. It might've been slightly moved around. So I can speak for a lot of projects that I know are taking layer two solutions a lot more serious than they were. Like everyone had it on their roadmaps, but it was, you know, a Q3, a Q4 item. And all of a sudden it moved up in schedule quite a bit because we saw that where we can, we need to move to these L2 and or roll-up solutions. So I don't see much changing in the builder landscape, really. These flash farms, and I've said it on one or two talks before, you know, they've caused more perception damage than they did builder damage. So they've set unreasonable expectations, which created a lot of noise and excitement. But that's the ammunition that people looking from the outside are going to use to say, oh, but look, the experiment failed. Because now it's already happening. I'm already seeing it even in the Yearn community where, you know, APIs dropped from, let's say, 80% down to single digits or, you know, low teens. And people are saying, oh, okay, but this doesn't work, or this isn't worth it, or this is pointless. But that's always the range we were aiming for. You know, the benchmark we set with Yearn V1 was 10% from Jan till July. So that's the benchmark. I'm not expecting more than that. I always tell people, you know, my South African banks, they offer 4 to 6% interest. And I mean that's very high in comparison to the rest of the world. So as long as I can build a system that outperforms that, it's doing its job. But on the perception side, everyone, I don't think anyone really believed it was sustainable, because there were enough of the traditional builders saying, look, guys, this isn't sustainable. This can't continue. But that narrative is so damaging, you know, because at the same time, when you have traditional finance guys looking in from the outside and they see 1000% APY, they don't investigate. They immediately decide, scam, I'm not going to touch it. But if they see 12% and they see, hey, it's been sustained for the last 6 months, that's something you start looking into. That's something you start investigating. So I'm personally a lot more worried about the damage that these flash farms and flash builders did in terms of the outside looking in narrative than I am about what damage it did inside of our ecosystem. Because, you know, all of the let's call it day-to-day crypto workers, we know which parts are sustainable. We know which parts we're moving to next. We know what's realistic to keep and have going forward, and where the damage is and where it isn't. And that perception, I don't think, has changed. Not from the people I've been talking to. That vision is still about the same. So it depends a lot on from what perspective you are looking at. I don't think on the builder side much has changed, really.
Yeah, that's fair. And especially when you're talking to real financial people, especially from Wall Street, they want to see sustainable yields that just, you know, beat or just aren't insane. I guess the taking the other side here, Andre, is there anything from the massive yield farming craze that you liked? Like, were there any new models built out, whether on fair launches or governance or community building or anything you saw in other projects that obviously, you know, may not have came during a normal, you know, a normal market cycle?
Yeah. So I think governance definitely took a lot of leaps, and we saw a lot of good tools around that. Now, again, this is something that has positive and negative connotations, you know, because there's this idea of fair launch that's about putting the control into your users' hands, there's so much stuff in our industry that, you know, sounds so good on paper, And when you tell someone, it sounds fantastic and it makes logical sense. But when you delve into it, you realize this doesn't actually make sense, or this isn't practical and it can't actually work. A perfect example is a completely community governed system. Sounds very nice on paper, but the community has other jobs. You know, they've got other full-time responsibilities. They don't want to. There's a reason politicians are politicians. You know, they're not a actuary by day and then at night go to, you know, wherever and you know, practice and sign whatever it is. I know nothing about politics, so I can't actually comment here. So what we've seen in terms of most of this governance is we've seen sort of self-elected officials be appointed from within these communities, and then they get appointed with certain executive controls and executive powers and these kinds of things, and they can make decisions, and they're the elected officials, if I can put it that way. That, I think, came out as a positive net sum, because even though when you look at it top down, it looks the same like any other organization. You know, you have elected officials who are executing on your behalf, et cetera, et cetera. But in most circumstances, that's a top down approach. You know, there's a leader or a president or a dictator or whatever it is, or a CEO, and they appoint specific entities to perform duties, and they sub appoint and so forth and so forth. And what we've seen with these fair launches, I really don't like calling them fair launches because nothing in life is fair. But what we've seen on the governance model side is we've seen people from the community be hoisted up and given powers. And if they don't perform those duties, it's very quickly taken away again as delegatory rights and these kinds of things. So I think we made some very interesting leaps and bounds in terms of decentralized governance, in terms of DAO, in terms of also taking it a step further, you know, because a tool like Snapshot also came out of all of this. And I think that's a very valuable tool. And I think we're going to see more things around that as well. Because with what we had with sort of the Compound launch, you know, that's very much a on-chain only governance, in that decisions are still made external and signaling is done external, but the what you can do on chain is a fairly rigid process, and that's done by code and handled by code and only by code. That's sort of absolutism governance, I want to call it. And then with the things like Snapshot and off-chain polling and off-chain voting and the decisions a community can make around a project that doesn't necessarily affect the code, I think was also a very interesting exploratory exercise that came out of this, because we've seen that communities want to be more involved than just what's happening on chain. You know, what the on chain is sort of the final permanence. That's the result of everything that happened. But there's a lot of stuff that could happen leading up to that, which I think is important. I think we learned a lot about in incentive models, and that balance between what incentive are you giving and what are you gaining from it, and tweaking that. I mean, we've seen Compound now go through a bunch of different iterations in trying to fine tune what they're paying people for versus what they're getting. Another thing I really like that we started seeing is, you know, protocols actually making revenue. This is something that we haven't seen before. Up until now, if you look at something like Token Terminal, they measure revenue of the system based on what an LP makes. You know, if I provide liquidity to Uniswap, how much am I making on a given day? But not actually how much does the Uniswap protocol make, which then I'm assuming pretty soon introducing a fee. Curve has introduced their fee. Yearn already has their fee. And this has already created a fairly positive feedback loop in terms of now the protocol has funds that can be assigned by these elected, let's call them officials or employees or whatever terminology you want to add. I don't actually think we have the vernacular for it, but these people, and they can actually receive remuneration, but it's also a new kind of remuneration, because it's did you do what you were expected to do, and then you are remunerated. You know, it's not a you will get paid month to month. And if you fuck up, there's a system whereby you first get a warning and then et cetera, et cetera. So it's also a lot more vicious environment, which I think was pretty much first sort of designed by Netflix culture, et cetera. But I think we've taken that a step further as well. So that was definitely positive. And I think we've, while I do believe we would have arrived at the same answers over a much longer spectrum of time, I think right now we've managed to condense it into a much shorter time period, which is good. We've also seen a lot of new models come out in terms of yield farming and how new ecosystems can exist around that, that sort of abstracts away from the user what's happening underneath while they can just enjoy the benefit of these systems. What I would like to see a little bit more, and that's one of the things I'm trying to push in terms of its narrative now, is that right now most of these yield farms are very parasitic in that they just, you know, farm this governance tokens and then immediately sell it to Compound for more profit for their LPs. But I think there's a balance there in between the LP receiving sufficient profit for them to be happy, but sufficient governance power actually being controlled by that protocol so that they can make decisions and changes that actually benefit going back as well. So I'm hoping to see more of that because I think that's a lot more mutualistic of a design than the current iteration we've seen. So anyway, very, very long ramble to basically come down to, yes, I definitely think there has been a lot of positive stuff. I don't necessarily think we wouldn't have discovered it if it wasn't for this craziness. I think we still would have arrived at the answer. It would have taken much longer. I'm trying to think if there's anything that really stands out from that. Oh, and like this, we've also seen this is a touchy topic, and I don't normally want to talk about it. But you know, we've seen the fork wars, where project A is forked into project B, and then what are its survivability odds? You know, we've seen the clean forks, and they die very quickly. We've seen the forks that are regional, and they seem to be holding on, but they're struggling on the innovation side. We've seen the forks that try to innovate, and they seem to be managing all right out of the lot, but they still live in the shadow of the one they forked. We've seen this concept of a vampire attack, but we've also now seen that as soon as those incentives stops, the liquidity just goes back to the original because the original is the one that's, you know, time tested and proven. So on in terms of sort of the threat models that these different protocols need to be aware of and how to combat against them, I think that's been a very, very rich learning experience. So that's definitely been fascinating. I don't necessarily think that would have happened otherwise, because most of the forks are opportunistic forks. You know, they didn't happen because of a ideological issue or a design philosophical issue. They purely happened because there was an opportunity for greed, and we've very clearly seen the net outcome of those. So yeah, no. Overall, I guess there's actually been quite a lot of internal positivity that have come from it. I don't think that's really tangible to people outside of, you know, our little crypto sphere, but I definitely a lot of valuable lessons there for the crypto 24/7 people.
Andre, that was awesome. Yeah, definitely not a ramble. There was a lot of interesting things you brought up there, especially on value accrual and fork wars and communities. I guess going back to when you started your answer, you're talking about the community and decentralization. How exactly, or what is your ideal form of governance when you're thinking about a project? Because I mean, for Yearn, you guys benefit from having a global community, you know, millions, potentially millions of people submitting strategies and new ideas. But at the end of the day, this is more on a community forum. It's not like they're, you know, making binary decisions here. And you obviously don't want to lose their interest, but you want them to be included. How exactly do you kind of wrestle with that? Because obviously not every community member should have a say or really cares or has the time to have a say.
I actually have very little input in that. That's not something I actually try to involve myself in. So the whole, I can't speak for other protocols, but you know, my goal with Yearn was to give it away 100%. I don't, and that's why I'm very, very apprehensive when people call me a founder or a leader or, you know, any of these words in context of Yearn specifically, because I'm trying to disassociate myself as much as possible. I want the community to self-organize, self-design, self-decide what's in the best interest of the protocol, you know, and I might not always agree, fairly often necessarily, don't agree with the direction they want to take it in, but the majority rule applies, you know, just like if you use a normal blockchain and the majority of the miners decide they're going to fork, that is the new true state. And I accept those same rules. You know, that's why governance exists. Governance exists so that we can have a Byzantine fault tolerant majority rules system and implementing that system. The conflict that I do see there is, you know, when governance votes on a topic and decides that XYZ execution has to occur. And this might not be on-chain enforceable, because on-chain enforceable is actually a little bit easier. But let's say it decides that the marketing direction should change the branding to, I don't know, red. And now you had the original, you know, elected designers that had made it blue, and they're against making it red. Now governance can't force them to do something they don't want to do. So even though governance now enacted that decision, they can't enforce it. So now they need to self-elect someone again that can take that over and enforce it. And I think that's a very interesting conflict area, which thus far hasn't arisen. Yeah, thus far hasn't arisen yet, because all of these governance protocols are still kind of in their honeymoon phase. So it doesn't really matter at this point. But I'm very curious what happens when we start seeing that. But me personally, I've been fairly transparent that I launched the token specifically to give away all of those obligations and responsibilities, so that it's, you know, it's someone else's problem. I want to just sit in my little dark corner of the room and code new stuff and not worry what happens after that.
Yeah, no, Andre, I think that's amazing, extremely authentic, and I love that you want to focus on the research full time. That's big. I guess my question for you though was, I mean, was it hard to give away control early on? Because I believe you gave away control to like 9 multisig holders. Like, it's got to be tough to do. And I guess my other question for you there is more of just a phasing one, is that like a lot of people obviously associate you with Urine, and I know you want to give it up to the community, which you clearly have, you know, financially, decisions, et cetera. But obviously, there's also the idea of a social figurehead. Do you think there'll ever be a time when you can leave Yearn and it will live on just as fast?
I not necessarily as fast. I mean, one individual will always be able to execute faster than a community that has to elect and make decisions in quorum. So if just focusing on that single keyword, fast, no. But do I think it can continue working and executing in the same fashion? Yes. So one example is, you know, I've already started removing myself from sort of the strategy development, and now people are already starting to complain, yeah, but why is it taking so much longer, and why aren't these things moving so fast, and do people not care anymore? But all that's happening is, you know, there's just different people that now first need to learn and get comfort and then do these things. So that transitionary process is going to be a slightly painful one that's going to take time, because at this point, a lot of the knowledge still exists with me, and that knowledge transfer has to happen before it can be properly decentralized and be run by other people. To answer the question of, is it painful to hand it over like this? Yes, 100%. It's been very hard handing over something that I've spent this much time and energy and passion into and just be hands off. I had originally concepts of doing a slow transfer that, you know, most of these other protocols are doing, where the team still controls majority, and sort of over time, the next few years, there's enough new tokens that community can start having a bigger say. I went with the Band-Aid approach, you know, rip it off. It's hope for the best, see what happens. It could have horribly failed. I think it turned out all right. Are there times I regret it? Definitely. There's often I look back and that I'm like, but you know, shouldn't I have kept that for myself, or shouldn't I have done that instead, or shouldn't I have this little bit of control? And to be plainly transparent, I often look back at the financial opportunity I gave up, which it sucks. Like I'm not going to try and say it's something it's not. But luckily, those aren't primary motivators for me, because what has happened is now, instead of the amount of maintenance and support time I was spending on the protocol, I can spend a lot of time on building new systems and innovating new products and continue releasing things I've had on my backlog for a very long time. So, you know, as with any decision in life, there's pros and cons. I do believe the pros outweigh the cons. But yeah, it's definitely been hard. There's definitely still a transitionary period that I think a lot of people will be unhappy with. But I still think the net result, you're always going to have that conflict, you know, like even with the tokens, with the slower release schedule where the community eventually takes over, they're still going to have that conflict point where the community starts taking over. So wherever you do it in a few weeks and you get it over and done with, or wherever you do it in a slow, prolonged, over a few years way, you're going to have those heartaches in any case. I just prefer to get things over with as quickly as possible when it's a bad thing to do.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I think getting it over with faster is better because it gives people less time to kind of, you know, not get married to you, but eventually move on, figure out how to do things, you know, take care of that knowledge transfer. I guess my other question on your response is more personal one. I mean, you definitely gave up a financial opportunity here, which does suck, right? It's human to think it doesn't, because Yearn's huge. You guys have $1 billion locked and et cetera. But do you think that Yearn and Wi-Fi would actually be where it was if the founders did take a large percent? Like, I feel like a lot of the, you know, the greatness and the awesomeness Yearn is that you guys gave it away.
Straight up, I don't think it would have been where it was today if it was like a traditional tokenomic design, or I did an investor raise or any of that stuff. It managed to become the financial giant it is because it attracted so much intellectual capital in people that were now themselves positioned to facilitate it. That's a bunch of words to really just say that normally when you have a tokenomic design and the team owns 60%, right? You as token holder, you think you're part of the 40% majority, you don't care. Team is 60%. So it's the team's job to make sure that there's value accrual for you. In the 100% just let it out there design, and there's definitely still a majority that hold me accountable for the value accrual, but the majority understand that, looks, these tokens are in their hands. They need to contribute to the ecosystem to make it worth it. So I don't, to answer the question very directly, you know, if it wasn't as broadly spread across as many influential individuals as it ended up being, no, I don't think it would have been the financial giant it's supposed to be. It is today. If I had gone with a traditional launch, I doubt this would have even, you know, broken like low 100 millions, probably less, probably, you know, in the 10-digit range.
That's fair. I appreciate the direct answer, and I definitely agree with you. And I guess you brought this up earlier on, and you just brought up again on the whole fair launch idea. I mean, Yearn is probably the fairest launch I think I've ever seen, but a lot of projects, they are doing fair launches, but it's not really fair distribution. You just have whales come in and buying up like the entire supply. How do you kind of think through the dynamic between fair launches and then eventual fair distribution?
I mean, look, as long as money is involved, people are going to find out how to game it. I mean, 2017 ICOs, we saw them try and add KYC limits. What happened? Whales bought entire call centers of people to KYC for them so that they can have more than one account that can buy the token.
You're right.
we've got these concepts of, okay, but now we can do you know, quadratic participations, or we can use curves. Those are all gameable. It's just going to be a gamed system. The Yearn just got really lucky in that, you know, when it launched, no one was expecting it. So the full amount of sort of, let's call it, big whale capital wasn't ready for it. It wasn't as trained as it is now So to quickly exploit these opportunities. And, you know, at the same time, most of these big funds were sitting on the sideline. They didn't know me. They didn't know what I've been building. They haven't been watching because there hasn't been an investor opportunity. So, you know, I'm not on their radar. So when it launched, they weren't the ones going into it. But the dev communities and the grassroots communities I'm in, they knew me. They've known what I've been building. So they went in quickly. So the sort of surprise and unpreparedness that everyone had was one of, and even though it's still not fair, I think that helped in terms of the fairness of the launch. But you can't do that today, you know, like everyone's so like most of these funds now have their personal Solidity developers on payroll to audit these smart contracts as soon as they open up to make sure that they can throw 100 mil in it. So they're so specialized now that model of distribution won't work. So in all of my recent podcasts, the ones I've been recommending to people is, you know, do a surprise launch, don't let people know, and do it retrospectively to the users of your system. So if I were to do it today, I'd still do it 100% to them, but I would do it retrospectively, and I'd do it to the participants that did do it retrospectively. So that's one of the things where I applauded the Uniswap distribution, because I think they did do that. They did do the surprise launch, and they did do the retrospective distribution, which I think in both sides are fantastic. But you know, in their circumstance, it's majority owned investors and teams, so they're doing the slow transition again. So each one has its own little caveat of, you know, where is it fair versus where is the other one fair. But like it's still subjective, you know. It's what is your definition of fair? Who are the people that should be rewarded, and why should they be rewarded? So that's. That's why personally I'm never excited when people say fair launch or anything like that. But my personal gripe is a terminology one, you know, with that word fair. I'm someone that fixates on specific word use in sentence quite a lot, and therein lies my issue. Saying this is a new, like a community launch, I would accept that even more appropriately, because you know, at least you're trying to exit to your community at that point. But yeah, so it's really just a terminology perspective there.
Andre, on the terminology thing though, like what if you have a project that is building brand new code and doesn't really have a community yet? Does the community launch aspect come into play after the project is launched and when it's going to do its token event, or like when the project actually launches?
I mean, this is this is another interesting one, right? Because like nowadays, everyone expects that everyone should do it the way it happened in Yearn. But like, I was very fortunate with Yearn in that, you know, before I got into crypto, I had a very well-paying CTO job at a very big local retail organization and worked in fintech. So you know, I managed to be fortunate in that. During that time, I paid off my house, I paid off my debts, I had very little living expenses and overheads. I live in South Africa. My monthly living expenses are less than like $300 a month. So I was in a fortunate position that I could build this protocol without having raised funds or needing to raise anything. But like that's a very unrealistic expectation of most builders. You know, they can't just give up the next 6 months or a year of their life and build hoping that there's going to be something cool that happens 6 months down the line. And now let's say by some miracle they are fortunate enough to be in that position. Now when they launch, it's also insane to expect them to give it away 100% because they worked so hard to get here. So I think the Yearn launch actually set a lot of really unrealistic expectations that I think is very unfair to put onto other builders, because if you hold them by that standard, you're setting them up for disappointment that isn't right. That sort of disclaimer aside, if we move that aside, then I definitely think, you know, like try and build your product out as much as possible. Get your POC, get your MVP, get some people using it. A lot of the teams I talk to that are launching new stuff now, they always have this 100% idea of how it should look. And I always tell them, look, 90% of the smart contracts I launched on chain are being used in ways I never thought they were going to be used in. So don't assume you know the product. You know, build your minimum viable as quickly as possible. Put it out there and see what people do with it, and start getting that feedback loop. But sorry, that's also another topic on the question. But yeah, ideally, see what kind of traction you have. See how the project is fitting up. But also, rather try and figure out alternative revenue models. You know, don't put a token in unless you absolutely have to. A lot of the new stuff I'm launching don't include the token. The V1 Yearn didn't use a token because a token didn't add any benefit to it. So there's also this idea now that all projects should have tokens. That's just not true. Some protocols need to be governed, and that's fine. They can have it, but the goal is still full decentralization. You know, launch something that no one needs to interact with, no one needs to upgrade. That's the end goal, because then you have an autonomous system. But again, that might be a completely unfair expectation, because who are you going to get that's going to spend, you know, the next 6 months to a year of intellectual capital and time and energy to build something that is just there and is to the benefit of everyone else? That's unfair altruistic expectations. But okay, let's move all of that aside, since that's a lot of ramblings. I do think build product first, get as much user feedback as possible, and then reward those users that helped you build to that point, because they're the ones that helped you define the project to get it to where you need to, and reward them retrospectively with a token launch, and then on the side, do what you need to do. But like until things like Gitcoin get more evolved, where you know it's capable of supporting these developers for longer amounts of times, I also don't think that's feasible. You're going to have to raise that initial capital, and you've got groups now coming out of the woodwork like Fair Launch Capital that are definitely trying to do that. But you know, there's a point where altruism just doesn't work, where there needs to be a quid pro quo, where if someone does something, they expect something back. And we're always going to struggle in that area. So there's sort of this, I guess like anything else, it's a spectrum, right? You know, there's sort of the absolute altruistic decentralized way. And then there's the absolute, I'm not even going to spend time and energy on this until someone funds me. And we try and sort of play on that spectrum and see what happens. I don't think there's a right answer for the question.
I don't think you had a ramble at all when you said that. I think an excellent answer. I guess my other question for you, though, as a follow-up is, obviously Yearn has a lot of moats. You know, liquidity, we could argue, is a moat. Community, we could argue, is a moat. But going back to the launch idea, and I don't know the right way to describe it, it was random, but it was perfect. And I don't think that could ever be replicated, even if it's authentic. And I don't know the right way to describe your launch, but it just seems so unique, and it's not easily or, you know, potentially ever going to be copied. Do you view that as kind of a moat as well?
I do. And you know, it wasn't by design that it ended up that way. It's complete luck and coincidence. I received enough good inputs and things happened organically in a way that was very favorable. But yeah, I mean, if you ask me to do it again today, it wouldn't have the same net effect. Like, if you follow those same steps, you will not end up at the same end result. So I do think that uniqueness definitely gives it a lot of value. But I don't know if I would call that a moat necessarily, because while that does give the project a certain mysticism, which I've always really loved, it's not the thing that's going to keep LPs providing their funds. That's simply, it needs to differentiate in terms of returns, security, and, you know, speed to market. And I mean, those are the usual three for any company. You know, that's what you get judged on. You know, sometimes you're going to use provider ABC because their returns might be less, but you trust them, they've been around longer, they're more secure, so you use them. Another time, you're maybe a little higher risk appetites, you're going to use the one that moves a little bit faster. And you know, we see that in traditional financial systems as well. The first thing that happens when you sit down with a consultant is they ask you what's your risk appetite. But anyway, circling back, like while I think that definitely adds a very sort of awesome story, I wouldn't go as far as to say that's one of the moats. I think the community need to need to stay on their toes. And if they become complacent, you know, they're going to lose their place in the ecosystem.
Yeah, that's fair. I definitely vibe with the competitive nature there and the framing. Andre, earlier or two questions ago, you talked about, you know, not releasing a token unless you absolutely have to. Let's say a project is going normal equity round, raises from VCs, et cetera, doesn't really release a token. How do they, and I definitely agree, it's unrealistic to assume that they would give away their entire project. Like, there's economic incentives at play. These people have bills, et cetera. How do these projects attract a community, though, if they're not giving away a token? Like, it's just very, very hard if you're not giving away a token, and then a lot of projects feel rushed to do so.
Like, why attract a community? You know, like that's my question always with all of these projects that are launching tokens or want to launch tokens and want to give away the token, which I respect. It's awesome that you want to give away the token, but why are you giving it away? Because you're not giving away a token. You are paying someone money. You're paying them a salary. You're paying them a finder's fee. You know, you're paying them something. You're rewarding them. And why are you doing that? So everyone always says they want these communities, but why? You know, what does this community bring to you? What value does it add? Like, if we look at Yearn again, you know, the community was created around three very specific steps. Step number one was you had to be a Yearn user and know how to use Yearn. Step number two was you had to understand how to provide liquidity and do yield farming stuff in this ecosystem. Step number three was you needed to know how to participate in governance, because those three steps were designed to find the correct caliber of person that could help build strategies. You know, they're trained enough that they know how to be an LP, how to go hunt down these yield opportunities, and then how to govern to actually manage to get these yield opportunities into the system. And that's the audience I needed. So that's the specific steps I set up to get the audience I wanted. But for a lot of other projects that have launched governance tokens, I'm not sure I understand what they're targeting with their audience. Because to me, you need to think of your token as a paycheck. You know, it's dollars that you're taking out of an account and you're giving it to someone else. And why would you do that? You do that to pay for a service. So again, I just don't think there's a blanket answer. I think it's very dependent on a specific product. Like I understand wanting to attract more liquidity if you're liquidity constrained. Sure, that makes sense. But you know, most of these projects now that are doing LP incentives already have billions under management. I'm not sure why they need to attract more. Or maybe you want, you know, a strong developer community, but then give it away at hackathons and those kinds of things. So the project first needs to identify what is the target demographic they want and how can they incentivize them, and then build a model around that. I think the ICO copy paste just made us so used to, you know, 30% team, 20% marketing, 15% advisors, 30% community, but they don't know what that community segment even means. It's just, you know, it's a line item that's supposed to be there, and we've become so complacent with that's what the model is supposed to look like, that we just keep copy and pasting it instead of challenging it and saying, but why is this line item here? Why am I spending this money? What am I gaining in the system to do this? Yeah, sorry, that was a much more aggressive answer than I thought I was going to give. But that's what it comes down to, you know, is evaluate why you want this community and what does this community do, and then reward them accordingly.
No, not aggressive at all, Andre. I think you're right. I think a lot of tokens don't make sense and attract a community just to attract a, you know, quote unquote community with no real, you know, plan on what they're actually going to add to a project or what they get in return. I guess a follow-up question for you is just, though, do you think the goal line shift a bit? Like, let's say Uniswap launched tomorrow and it was a brand new project and they gave away a token to attract liquidity and grew to be the behemoth it is today. Obviously, in hindsight, giving away the token's kind of stupid because they have, you know, so much liquidity, but early on they kind of needed some incentives to get there. Do you think there's a shift in some projects where maybe it makes sense to launch one, but over time it doesn't, or vice versa? I'm just kind of wondering where the narrative shifts.
100%. So it comes down to what are you paying for? So, you know, if you just launched a new protocol, people are scared to use it. They don't want to make that first move. They need to have a risk-adjusted reason to join your system. And your system might be able, let's say you launch a new option system today. Now you have to consider for your LPs, it's going to be capital inefficient. They're going to lock that up. There's going to be opportunity costs. They might have to lock it up for at least, 3 weeks, 3 months. So there's that on top of that. So you're going to struggle to get liquidity providers. So in that case, yes, you need to bootstrap them a little bit, but only up until the point where that comfort level is there, where, people are used to, okay, this is working. This has proven itself. This is fine. And then you need to shift models. And this is probably a difficult one for me to say, because I'm a strong believer in immutability. My contracts aren't upgradable. There's no proxy patterns, because I think immutability is a feature. But when it comes to a token, you need to think of that more like a treasury. Its immutability is not necessarily the best thing, because what you incentivize today isn't necessarily what you want to incentivize tomorrow. And you might also, pivot the organization. Now, sure, you can just launch a new token then, but the more times you do that, the more times you degrade your existing community that might have helped you get to the specific point you wanted to. But definitely, I think new protocols should incentivize their users, especially in a risk-adjusted way, to give them comfort and to be able to attract. But, don't make it 400% reward. Just give them the smallest amount that attracts them. Another thing that I'd like to start seeing is, projects that start with giving out zero. Like, start at zero. And then if you don't get liquidity, ramp it up to 2%. And if you still don't meet your targets, ramp it up to 5%. But, start bottom up, not top down. Because most people start on the extreme end and then sort of work their way in. It's just like people are just copy and pasting the same model too much. And there's not enough, how do we make this sustainable, and too much, oh, but company XYZ did it, so we can just copy that design and it's going to work the same. Yeah. There's just a lack of innovation when it comes on the tokenomic side currently, because we're so ingrained in how it's supposed to look.
I'm with you there. I definitely think the framing should be lower issuance over the long term. I mean, it's dependent on price for yields, but so that's, you actually have multi-year sustainable projects. And Andre, just taking the other side of this, because we're just seeing so many launches, and up the line of my last question, do you think we'll ever get to a point where projects initially launch a token with a goal of eventually buying it back and retiring it? Like, because obviously it's hard to shift incentives between stakeholders, and eventually you might not need a token for a larger project. So I'm wondering if you expect tokens to actually go away for larger projects, and if that's even possible.
From an ideological perspective, yes, I'd love to see that happen. I hope to see it happen. Like tokens are the crutch at the start to sort of bootstrap. And then as the protocol exists into its own and it has revenue, it should try and sort of destroy the token. Like even though you launch it, your objective should be to get rid of it. And I mean, obviously, it's now in the hands of your community. But when I launched it, one of my primary objectives was, how do I get to the point where I can destroy the token? Because that's when the system is working. It's important at the start when you're doing your discovery and all of your architecture might not be in place and you need to incentivize liquidity. But once you have those blocks in place, get rid of the bloody thing. It's a crutch at that point, not actually part of the solution. So I'd hope to see that. Realistically, I just doubt it, because the open nature of these protocols does mean for a lot of them, it's going to be a zero-sum game where, it's going to get forked and the fee is going to get lowered and then another one's going to come in and fork that one. And eventually all of them are going to end up with zero. And then revenue disappears. And when revenue disappears, there does need to be something else. And that's where something like a token does add value. So the ideological answer is yes, I'd love to see that. The practical answer is I highly doubt that will happen in any applicable system. But the more specific answer is, again, there isn't really a blanket statement to this. It's so nuanced on each project that you can't. It's like saying all companies should have the same share structure, because shares is something that they can dilute or they can add more or they can make room for a new investor. It's something that's very mutable based on the requirements and needs of the organization at a specific point in time. So I always view it as closer akin to something like that, where even though your goal might be to take it private again and, you know, not have the shares out there, realistically, you're probably going to keep having it out there. But what I would like to see is I would like to see a lot more experimentation in different models. I think we have become too complacent in the one size fits all tokenomic design at this point.
No, I'm with you there. I think we definitely need more creative kind of juice for the token economic side. And full disclosure, I own Wi-Fi and Delphi Ventures does as well. Just had to say that as well for transparency. And Andre, just closing out on the token econ side, Yearn is really interesting because you guys have revenue and it's model. You could build models like we would on a normal equity research shop. But what's your, I guess, obviously there's no one size fits all, but how do you kind of think through value accrual, whether it be a burn, whether it be flowing to a treasury, whether it be like a streamed reward? It just gets really complex because you want something that's easy to model, but you also want to align incentives for those who are actually like adding to the project, where like a burn benefits everybody, even though it's not helping, whereas something like pulling to a treasury can help people that are actually staking and are engaged. How do you kind of think about those trade-offs on the value accrual and community side of things?
So, I mean, the current design in Yearn is based on my own sort of layman expectations. So revenue is standardized into Y curve at this point, but it basically comes down to USD. You know, it's whether it be DAI or USDT, it doesn't actually matter the form it takes. And the reason for that is I want to put that choice in the person that earned it. So I don't want to decide for them, you're going to get the token. Because what I saw with a lot of projects I used to advise in the past is, you know, if you give people a token, as much loyalty as they have to the project, they can't pay their rent with the token. They can't go buy food with the token. So you're putting them in a very awkward position where they kind of have to sell it to be able to facilitate their day-to-day. And that creates a certain negativity that I didn't like. But that's less from a you know, design side and more from a human psychology side. So that's why I always like the idea of, hey, here's the token. Here's fiat for argument's sake. You make your choice. If you wanna spend 50 on that, on doing a buyback, that's awesome. Go for it. Versus something like a buyback and burn, you know, that doesn't create cash flow. So you argue supply gets scarcer, so demand increases. Realistically, we've seen enough tokens do large buyback and burns with fairly insignificant effect, if any. So I think that one's a little bit of a meme. One I've been looking into a lot now that recently came out, even though I'm sort of bastardizing how it came out, is the buyback and make, which I've slightly modified to buy back and market make. So the idea there is, you know, so something like Yearn is making an income in to keep it simple, in DAI, and then 50% of that goes into token, the other 50% stays in DAI, and that goes into Uniswap. So you're actually creating the market for that as well. And then it's up to the recipient, you know, do they, when they take that out, do they keep it in that proportion? Do they sell the DAI to more of the token? Do they sell the token to more of the DAI? It's still in their hands. But instead of having idle liquidity, in Yearn's case, which is just sitting in a contract, it itself is working. Because I'm a firm believer that all capital should work. And if your money isn't making money, then it's being lazy and you need to do something about that. So that's a model nowadays that I'm quite a strong believer in. I think that align sort of all incentives close enough that it's a pretty good model. And I think our ecosystem is rich enough that it actually makes sense to do it that way. And, you know, it comes with other positive benefits as well, because the more liquidity you have sitting there that's actually market making for you, the better it is for your users that want to purchase and or exit, dependent on their position. So that's one I'm currently really liking and actually recommending to most projects to do. But you know, as you said, there's no blanket answer here. But that's definitely my current preferred design.
I like that. That's really good framing on all those things. And I definitely agree that it varies project to project. And Andre, one of my last questions for you, and I hate to say years in crypto because the space moves so fast, but I think we're both a believer that space is going to be here for a while. I mean, if you had to look ahead, you know, 1, 5, or 10 years, you could pick the time frame that you most want to answer for. I want to know what you think Yearn will look like just looking ahead, and you could pick the time frame here because it's a hard question.
I mean, with Yearn, we're building an empire. You know, there's not one thing. So Yearn, as the asset management capital system it is today, it can exist in the same fashion it is now, just a lot more intelligent. Like Yearn right now is kind of dumb. Like it doesn't do waterfall strategies. It doesn't do hedging. It doesn't, you know, protect capital against outside influences or stuff like this. So it is just going to get smarter, you know. So I don't mean to downplay that, but you know, if we look at a bank and we go 100 years back, that was a vault that kept your money in it. Now, if we fast forward 100 years, it's still just a vault that keeps your money in it, but it comes with so much more stuff around that makes it, you know, powerful. So even in a year, 5 years, 10 years from now, the time frame doesn't really matter. It itself is just going to become more and more intelligent. But what I think is going to happen alongside that is, you know, it's going to create sub industries that supply towards that, like things like the stable credit we want to roll out alongside Aave that has it's more scalable on the in quotes stable coin. I don't really want to call it a stable coin, but it's more stable. It's more scalable on that side than current solution. It's more scalable in terms of the amount of capital that it can actually deploy. But it in itself is its own little, you know, sub industry. It's its own new design, even though it's built to facilitate Yearn. And something like leverage trades that we're going to start seeing more of with things like Y-Trade or Synthmix. I know their market, which they renamed to. These are, again, you know, new industries, but they facilitate volume, and that volume facilitates underlying yield. So that, again, ties back into Yearn. So I'm looking forward to seeing a lot more of the ecosystem develop and evolve to facilitate this beast. But if you just isolate it and you look at any given time frame, I think it's going to look the same. It's just how intelligent it is just going to change over time. And that's really all it's supposed to do, because it shouldn't matter to the LP investing now whether they're going to withdraw their money in a year's time or 5 years' time. They should always have that comfort that it's just going to get better. So where I think the real innovation is going to be, and where the real advancement and the real development is going to be, is all of the ecosystems and industries that's going to start appearing around it to facilitate it.
That's incredible, Andre. This was super interesting. I love talking to you, and I really appreciate you coming on the podcast today.
No, it's a pleasure, my man. I actually really like having these. The one reason I was excited about coming out onto this one is you like asking real questions. Like, if I have to do one more podcast where I have to tell people my background and how I got into this industry, I'm going to shoot myself. So
I appreciate that, Andre.
It's refreshing having, you know, these real in-depth conversations. So I actually really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, of course, Andre. I really appreciate that and your time, and can't wait to share this and have you on again soon.
Legend, my man. Just let me know and I'll make the time.
I love that.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon. Mm-hmm.